Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
It's Thursday night. It's just gone past 7:45. It's May the 1st, 1980, and your host, Al Needham, that's me, is hunched over the portable telly in his bedroom with a copy of the brand new Smashes by his side, deciding which skinny tie to wear at the youth club later on. But most of all, cramming every second of this episode of Top of the Pops into his gaping maw. Hey up, you pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to the final part of Chart Music 68, as we rejoin the episode in progress. Skinheads are magic!
Well, you heard of the Great Wall of China, that's the Great Wall of Noise. That was Motorhead and Leave In Here. Hi, girls!
Hi, Tom!
Great singers, but not as good as the Nolans, who don't make any waves.
Vance, surrounded by even more appallingly bouffanted young ladies, tells us that we've had the Great Wall of China, but now we've witnessed the Great Wall of Noise. He then sings, "Hi, girls," and they respond with, "Hi, Tom," so that Vance can coat them down when he tells them they're nowhere near as good as the next act, the Nolans, with Don't Make Waves. Jimi Hendrix, Public Enemy, U2, Joy Division, Marvin Gaye, Elvis Presley, Public Image Limited, Bruce Springsteen, Sly and the Family Stone, Bob Dylan, Led Zeppelin, James Brown. None of those have ever been covered on Chart Music, but we're about to talk about the fucking Nolans for the fifth time. This is the follow-up to I'm in the Mood for Dancing, which got to number 3 for 2 weeks in February of this year. It came out a month ago and entered the charts at number 58, and when it soared 24 places to number 38 the following week, they were ushered into the Top of the Pop studio, which gave it a 9-place leg up to number 25. This week, it stayed at number 25, but no matter, it's the fucking Nolans. They're back.
Oh, God.
At last.
Yes.
At last. We've done the Nolans, as you say, so many fucking times, and it's almost become a running joke when I'm on the show that it's a shame it's not Don't Make Waves. Well, at fucking last, it is Don't Make Waves.
Yeah, you better like it, Simon.
Yeah. No, it's shit. I want to talk about it in terms of disco evolution, okay?
Ooh.
Because this subclade begins with a common ancestor of Rock the Boat by Hughes Corporation, produced by John Flores, who was obviously of Hispanic descent, but from Los Angeles. But then Rocky Baby by George McRae, produced by Casey and the Sunshine Band, Miami. So it's got that kind of Latino feel that both those records have. So, so you've got that as the ancestors. Then, most importantly, I think in this case, Dancing Queen by ABBA, because that was ABBA's attempt to make their own Rock Your Baby and to take that kind of Latin syncopation. And Don't Make Waves is post-ABBA. Not that I'm by any means placing Don't Make Waves on the same level as Rock Your Baby or Dancing Queen. Mm. But it's got the DNA of that Latin disco sound filtered through Northern European mum pop sensibilities.
Yeah.
What I love about the structure of this song is that the intro, vocally, kicks in halfway through the chorus. That bit that goes, so let our hearts roam free if you wanna love me. You know, it's like halfway through. And that's a really clever little songwriting trick because it's the most exciting bit of the song. And it's a really clever way to get you hooked in to do like half of the chorus before you actually do the song.
Yeah.
It's produced by Ben Findon and co-written by Findon with Robert Pusey and Mike Myers, not the Austin Powers one. Probably not the baddie from Halloween. You never know. they were all established journeymen and hacks of middle-of-the-road pop, right? Their fingerprints are all over the Doolies, for example, who are very much the John the Baptist to the Nolan's Jesus. Findon did loads of Schlager and Europop prior to this, which you can kind of tell. But he did also produce and co-write Love Really Hurts Without You for Billy Ocean. And even better than that, Red Light Spells Danger.
Oh, wow.
Which is literally one of the greatest records ever made. So this guy, he's a hack who knew what he was doing and capable of flashes of genius. For me, this song is a tiny flash of genius and by far the best thing the Nolans ever did.
Right.
The performance here is bog standard Nolans doing their symmetrical sororal choreography in silver jackets and salmon tops and black slacks and bright pink belts with, I thought, a slightly phallic dangle on the end of each
belt. Funky belt.
That's it, is it? That's the belt you're talking about.
Yeah, they're wearing funky belts. I mean, they look as if all the women in Greece were outfitted by the K's catalogue. You know what I mean?
I'm so glad what we cleared it up in the same episode. We cleared up what a funky belt was. This is really good. But yeah, the whole thing, it's total cruise ship. There's no sex, no sleaze, just wholesome entertainment. Although looks can be deceptive, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute. I'll hand over to Neil now.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say this is like one of the probably your favourite Nolan shit. I mean, I kind of wish this was any of the other singles off the Making Waves album. Because sexy music, I'm fairly sure that might have formed the melodic inspiration behind my sister's game of Disco Lights, by the way. Might have been made for a better performance. Or the mighty, you know, Who's Gonna Rock You? Co-written by Billy Ocean, funnily enough. So there's that Billy Ocean connection there. But I would have loved Who's Gonna Rock You to be on this episode because they might have played the video, which starts with one of the greatest sight sound gags ever. Linda Nolan starts the song on the recorded version with a kind of disco yowl, and in the video, to make that believable, she's running a bath about to hit the town, and then she puts her foot in this hot bath and she does this loud yaroo, which is worthy, you know, it's like Babyface Finlayson or something.
Oh my god, that's like, there was this tradition in the local cinema in Barry. I don't know if I've talked about this before.
No,
but you know, cinemas in those days, probably not so much anymore, would have local adverts in the trailers as well as sort of national ones. And there was one in Barry for a local kind of carpets and flooring retailer. What it was, there was a woman getting up in the morning in her dressing gown, and she's walking down lovely thick plush carpeted stairs until she gets to the bottom, and it's cold tiles. And when she puts her bare foot on the cold tiles, everybody in the cinema would scream, and it's just this thing that became a local tradition, and I fucking loved it. I wonder if there's anything else out there like that, just these like weird little local things that grow up. But in response to that advert, the woman in the advert doesn't scream, she just sort of flinches a bit, but people would scream. And you just reminded me of that. It's a nice memory to have.
The thing is with this song, it sounds like it was written at a much slower pace and has been kind of a little bit artificially discoed up, I think, that doesn't really suit the kind of like rather dreary anthemic melody. I don't think they benefit from what they're wearing.
No.
As has been mentioned. I know they couldn't wear the same thing as they did on the Lena Zavaroni show, but when they do this on the Lena Zavaroni show, they wear these sort of purple pantsuits that are way more flattering. What this really made me think about, though, I was reading a thing with a video director, an interview with a video director from the early 80s, and he was talking in general about when he's got in trouble with his videos, and he said that in one of the Nolan's videos he does, Maureen Nolan looks tearfully at a picture of her old boyfriend and then throws it in a river. And this video is banned in case it made people throw litter. So there you go, Nolan's kicking out the jams. But yeah, bit of a low spot for me in this show.
I mean, like Bugs Fizz in a few years' time, the Nolans are trapped in that limbo between actual pop stardom and the cabaret circuit, as a review in The Stage a few months hence bears out.
Right.
The image of the Nolans has been given a glossy veneer of late, a fact that was reflected throughout their recent show at Wembley. Surely not the stadium.
No.
There were the smooth and sexy costumes, provocative and exhausting dance routines, and material that will go down a treat on the disco floor. These contrast somewhat disconcertingly with the clean-cut, girl-next-door giggles, but no matter. By the enthusiasm shown at this concert, there is a place in the hearts of many middle-aged, middle-class mums and dads for this kind of entertainment. Like the Osmonds, they are family life on parade. Middle-of-the-road classics, ancient and modern, abounded, with the newest and youngest of the group, Colleen, leading the way with Touch Me in the Morning. She's 15, everyone. A medley of songs from the last few decades provided a range of styles, from a neat Charleston number to rock around the clock, and, much to the astonishment of the audience, a quick blast of punk.
What?
Yeah, I'd love to know what punk. Oh my God.
Well, the thing is, in terms of their sort of family-friendly, wholesome image, obviously that was deceptive. I think we have to talk about what happened backstage at this very episode of Top of the Pops.
Yes.
Motorhead and the Nolans did meet up, and there was an attempt by Lemmy to cop off with one of them. I found interview quotes from both sides to confirm this happened.
Ooh, okay.
So here is from Lemmy's side, right? He says, no, there was no fling, but it wasn't for the want of trying. They are awesome chicks. People forget, those girls were on stage with Frank Sinatra at the age of 12. They've seen most things twice. Mm. We were on Top of the Pops at the same time as them, and our manager was trying to chat up Linda, the one with the bouffant hair and the nice boobs. He dropped his lighter and bent down to pick it up. Linda said to him, while you're down there, why don't you give me a dot, dot, dot?
Ooh.
It blew him away. We didn't expect that from a Nolan sister. None of us did. We were supposed to be the smelliest, loudest motherfuckers in the building, but we more than met our match. We were in awe.
Wow.
You couldn't mess with the Nolan sisters. That's from Lemmy's point of view. In Colleen's version, it was Lemmy himself, not the manager, who dropped something on the floor and bent down to pick it up, only to be given the while you're down there, love, treatment from Linda. Mm. And Colleen says the look of shock on his face was priceless. He thought he'd have to watch his behaviour in front of the Von Trapps.
Yes.
And there was Maria Von Trapp being so crude. From that point on, he realised we were ordinary people and we got along great. Colleen also says Lemmy was the nicest, most intelligent, philosophical person you could ever meet. He'll probably be turning in his grave now I've said that. Though I was terrified when I met him for the first time in 1981. She's got the year wrong there. I was a Nolan sister and he was this scary-looking heavy metal guitarist. Colleen continues, but he found out that the Nolans weren't that innocent either. When we did Top of the Pops, he bent over to pick something up in front of us and Linda said, while you're down there. So there we go. It's confirmed by both sides.
Wow.
So the following week, Don't Make Waves soared 10 places to number 15. And 2 weeks later, it got to number 12, its highest position. The follow-up, Gotta Pull Myself Together, got to number 9 for 2 weeks in October and November of this year, by which time Linda and new member Colleen Nolan teamed up with Mickey Moody of Whitesnake, Bob Young, a songwriter for Status Quo, Cozy Powell and Lemme in the Young and Moody Band for the single Don't Do That.
Well, which is one of the great incongruous hookups in pop history, along with Shawaddy Waddy supporting Einstein's Ender Neubauten.
Mm.
But yeah, it's just a sort of standard kind of blues rock knees up, very much in the same vein as who was it who did Hold Me? It was Maggie Bell and B.A. Robertson. Is that
yes.
kind of, yeah, that kind of feel to it. That's what it's like. Yeah,
and not the only collaboration between the Nolans and Motorhead, as we'll discover later.
Oh.
Yeah, if you want.
Scotland, Ireland, now they're totally international. The Nolans are 25 on the charts and Don't Make Waves. Now, let's go into the bathroom and see the mirror and the beat.
After telling us how international the Nolans are, Tommy, on his own this time, invites us into the bathroom and guides us towards the mirror and introduces the next band, The Beat, with Mirror in the Bathroom. We've wanged on about how fucking skilled The Beat are many a time and often on Chart Music, and this, their third single, which was written before they'd even got a deal with Two Tone or anyone else, is the follow-up to Hands Off She's Mine, which got to number 9 in March of this year. It's also the third cut from their forthcoming debut LP, I Just Can't Stop It, which comes out at the end of the month. It's automatically entered the chart this week at number 58, but that is not going to deter Top of the Pops from ushering them into the studio. Two words, boys. Fucking yes!
Oh, God, this is amazing.
Yes.
And it's another moment in the show where I feel like pulling some of the audience up by their lapels and just snarling.
Oh,
what
yes.
the fuck are you doing? How are you staying still? This is fucking astonishing.
Yeah.
You know, The Beat, whenever they're on Top of the Pops, they're always dazzling because they're just a band that have so much. They've got two absolute stone-cold heartthrobs in Dave and Roger. You've got Saxa just being the coolest motherfucker on earth.
Oh, yes.
I mean, this song had particular resonance in my household at the time because it put my sister, Mira, through that thing that no kid wants, having their name mentioned in a popular song.
Oh,
you know, having it sung at her.
Of course.
Mira in the bathroom,
no,
yeah?
No.
And I mean, I got the same a year or so later when Dollar's little-known B-side, Neil Kulkarni is a Wanker, got some radio play. But for a while, this song massively wound my sister up, and as her little brother, I felt that residual resentment too. But my God, what a record. And I mean, as you say, I mean, what a year for albums and singles 1980 is. Susie Banshee's coming out with Kaleidoscope, Diana Ross, Diana, the Linton Kwesi Johnson album we mentioned, Warm Leatherette, Remain in Light, more specials. It's just an amazing year for albums. You've got to put I Just Can't Stop It in that company.
Yes.
And in the NME 50 Tracks of the Year for 1980, The Beat have three singles in the top 30, yeah. which no other band does.
Yeah, two top 10 singles already this year. It's only May the 1st, and this has the words Nailed on Hit written all over.
Oh, without a doubt. And they've been sitting on it as well. That's really crucial.
Yes.
It reminds me of a quote from not Dave Wakeling and the other Dave, where in an interview that year, he says, I think there are three things you should have in a band. You should be sort of poppy, weird, and you should be able to dance to it. And that is this record to a T. It's such a weird little record.
In today's issue of Smash Hits, which I would have had close to me while watching this, the singles page absolutely frothed at the gash over this song. Mm. In short, their best yet, wrote A Small Creature in Shorts. Pumping rhythm, clip guitar, a song that is the very model of Simple Insistence, and the whole thing is topped off with some marvellous sax playing that weaves in and out of the structure. Hear it twice and you feel like you've known it for years, and fucking hell, that Small Creature in Shorts was not lying.
Oh, too right.
I don't think this was the first time I heard the song. I think I heard it on the radio a few times. But yeah, the minute you hear it, it's like, fuck
oh,
me,
God, it's in there.
Point me in the direction of the record shop now.
Which is mental for a record with, I mean, really no chorus, bar a repeat of the title. But eventually the lack of a chorus becomes its own chorus, this incessant repetition.
Yes.
And this hovering around this very sort of downward minor key pattern. But it's massively danceable rhythmically. There's these long lines of lyrics where the lines grow into these sinister insistences on, you know, watching yourself whilst you're eating and stuff. It chilled me as a child. It still chills me now. Mm. And watching this performance, you get the sense with the way that the beat put this across, just how much they've waited for this moment. Not only is this song an old song that's more reflective of them as personalities than perhaps the covers were, but it feels like the first moment where this band are able to exert some autonomy over what they put out, and it's a really important statement. They're brilliantly served as well, I have to say, by the antics of the backroom boys at Top of the Pops with some excellent mirrored split-screen action and stuff.
Yes.
Appallingly served by the audience, but fuck me, what a moment in the episode this is.
Yeah, it's not just the sort of computery stuff they do with the split-screen horizontal and, you know, Dave Wakeling being mirrored. It's literally the handheld looking glass that Roger has, isn't it? And he does that thing where he angles the looking glass just perfectly so he can stare into it and see down the camera. That's a lovely little touch, isn't it? This song, as you say, was always in their locker. They had it at their sleeve. I interviewed Dave Wakeling a couple of years ago now, and he was telling me about this, that, well, basically it all began in the summer of 78 when he and Andy Cox went down to the Isle of Wight to earn a bit of money fitting solar panels to houses. And they were staying in a house in Blackgang Chine, which has since fallen into the sea. And while they were there, they just started playing in local bands for something to do. But they decided they wanted to start up their own thing, and they advertised locally for a bassist. That's how they found David Steele.
Oh, could have had Mark King. Mark King could have been in the beat fucking hell.
Parallel universe, yeah, geez. But yeah, David Steele, the man that Wakeling describes as the Mozart of the band, he's the one on this performance, and pretty much every performance, who does that mad ankle tangling dance which Saxa called the shuffle, and Dave said that they all tried to copy it but none of them could do it. So only he can do it. A lot of the songs on that first album, I Just Can't Stop It, were written down in the Isle of Wight while they were fitting these solar panels, including Mirror in the Bathroom. David Steele was training as a mental health nurse.
Yes.
But he decided to move to Birmingham with the other two when they went back and carry it on to give the beat a chance. And songs like this are all about his bass lines, really.
Yeah.
And it was, it was always up their sleeve. As they started playing live and their reputation grew, there was a sort of watershed moment where they played John Peel's Roadshow at Aston University, which is their first gig with proper PA and lights. John Peel went fucking apeshit for them.
Right.
He introduced them as the best band in the universe after the Undertones.
Right.
So the reputation was spreading, and Jerry Dammers came along to check them out because he'd heard rumours about them and saw them as kind of competition, I suppose. Obviously, he was blown away, and he offered them a record deal with Two Tone. And he said to them, I mean, he already had in mind, he said, that Mirror in the Bathroom for the first single, right? Ooh. And they said to him, yeah, that's probably the one. But then when Dammers showed them the paperwork, the contract with Two Tone and Chrysalis, and it said that Chrysalis would keep the song for 5 years and they couldn't have it on their album. Right. So they said no. And the way they got around it quite diplomatically was they said, all right, you can have Tears of a Clown and you can argue with Smokey Robinson about whose song it is.
Yeah.
And also Tears of a Clown, or, you know, the first beat single, whatever it may have been, was coming out at Christmas. So they said, just watch, it'll do better if we hold on to this one. You don't want a song about one of Dave's nervous breakdowns. Save that for the new year when everyone's thinking about killing themselves in February. Which is really smart because, you know, they're sort of leading Two Tone along, sort of implying that, yeah, you know, we'll stick with you and we'll put that single out. But of course, what they had up their sleeve was they're going to quit. So they do Tears of a Clown / Ranking Full Stop on Two Tone, and then they leave. And in a way, surprising, but also very canny, that this isn't even the first single on their own label. As you say, Hands Off She's Mine comes first, which is a brilliant song, but it's a bit more lightweight and a bit sort of less substantial than Mirror in the Bathroom. So they were just sort of finding their feet and building their audience. And it was a superb move to set up their own label, Gofi, rather than just signing directly to Arista, because in a way, it became their mirror, if you'll pardon the pun, of Two Tone.
Yes.
They had their own identity that the parent label, the big, you know, in Two Tone's case it was Chrysalis. The big bad label is hiding behind this kind of independent looking front. And it's really important as well that the Beat had a girl as their logo, the Beat Girl.
Yes.
Dave Wakelin's talked about this as well, about they wanted to provide a counterpoint to the kind of blokey thing of Two Tone having Walt Jabsco. Mm. It's in the hope that girls would feel more welcome coming to their gigs. And, you know, apparently that did work. That's my next tattoo, by the way. The other thing about this, already it's not Scar. Because... Tears of a Clown, ranking full stop, very, very high octane, sped up Scar. Even Hands Off, She's Mine, although that's almost got a kind of Afrobeat element to it. It's got an African thing going on. But by this point, I don't know what it is. I guess it's funk. It's paranoid funk. It's funk having a nervous breakdown, as Dave puts it. Mm. It's a dance record about mental illness, for fuck's sake. Mm. You know, which shouldn't work. But it's about agitation and paranoia. And it sounds agitated and paranoid. So in that sense, it is musical onomatopoeia. Even the thing about having a glass table where you can watch yourself while you're eating. Mm. As an adult, you think of reflective surfaces and you think of cocaine, you know. Mm. So there is that kind of cocaine paranoia.
Or Keith Joseph.
It is funk, but I think sax is up there ante a little bit in terms of the way... I mean, what Dave's playing on the guitar... It's almost jazz. He's playing some really quite weird shit on his guitar. So, it doesn't neatly fit into any pigeonhole you'd care to shove it into. It's just this unique little thing. And I keep saying little thing. It's a fucking massive thing.
Yeah, Sax is very much the Joey the Lips, isn't he, of the Beat.
I love him because whenever he's interviewed at the time, people want to know, you know, what have you learnt from this? And he just keeps saying, nothing. I'm not learning anything from these guys. But he loves them.
I love how Dave Wakeling and Rankin Roger do reflect the subculture that they are part of by wearing Harringtons.
Yes.
And they just really look the part.
Yes.
But Saxa has Saxons.
Yes.
But, you know, he's old. But he's old. He can wear what the fuck he wants. He's old, you know. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. You don't want him in a bomber jacket like Tommy Vance, do you? As with the Specials and Madness, and with a band that we're going to see later on, there was endless playground debate amongst the fourth and fifth year contingent over if you could be a mod and like this sort of thing. But for a newly minted 12-year-old like me and my peers, there are no qualms whatsoever. This is fucking mint.
Yeah. Well, it is a little bit more mod than a lot of the ska bands.
There was a bit of argument in the music press over whether the Beat were mod or not.
Well, it's because it's so sharp what they're doing. You know?
Yes.
It's got that kind of nervous energy that a lot of the best stuff by The Jam also had.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't think it's too much of a leap for Jam fans to be Beat fans and Beat fans to be Jam fans, put it that way.
We were having a go at Saxon for wearing band T-shirts. Dave Wakelin's got not one but two Beat badges on his Harrington, And, of course, talking about the Beat Girl, there would be the second most plastic mod badge ever after Madness Modness. No, probably the third, because there was the other one, wasn't there? There was the Secret Affair badge with a nutty boy looking through a keyhole. Well, fucking plastic, mate. Plastic cut-out badge of Walt Jabsco and the Beat Girl on a scooter.
Oh, I've got it. I've got that one.
Yes.
I actually had an even more shonky Beat badge than any of those, which was, it was just a round button badge. But, you know, the logo was the letters all kind of wonky next to each other.
Yes.
But the B was like a the flat symbol for music from staves, you know. But on this one, they just put a normal capital B. For fuck's sake. But I still wore it.
Of course you did.
Because I'd spent 25p on it. Pathetic.
It's a very mod lyric in any case, with its apparent nods at narcissism.
Mm.
Obviously, it's a bit deeper than that. But yeah, I would be watching this and absolutely champing at the bit for my Saturday afternoon excursion into town. And it goes without saying that whenever this hit the decks at the community centre or the youth club, it would go the fuck off.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we all do a bit of DJing, right? You know? And I run my own club night, Spellbound 80s night, and obviously we play the Beat. When I stick this on, people absolutely lose their shit. It's just you cannot fail with this track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter what you are into round our way, practically everybody danced the same. That rhythmic leg-kicking dance.
Yeah.
The only difference was what you added to it. So the punks would kick their legs, but also windmill their arms around. The mods and the rude boys would kind of like pump their fists close to their chest. And the skinheads would just try to kick the punks and the mods. So Yeah, just one dance, but so many variations. A council estate can.
It's funny, though, the mod confusion, because, I mean, I remember reading an interview with Dave Waitland where he says that at the time they were playing gigs, and literally the mod revival crowd would be in the audience, like, just shouting, mod. They'd shout mod until they heard some mod music. And he'd say, you know, this was a big hit, and, you know, sort of back in the 60s, and the people would lose their shit. But, I mean, the thing is, this is closer to that mix of black musical obsession and artiness that is mod, far more than the fucking Merton Parkers or something, you know.
Chords, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
The whole album, I Just Can't Stop It, is totally a dance record, start to finish. It's just incredible. And I think the beat have kind of slipped through the cracks of history a little bit. And I think we've talked about this before when we've dealt with the beat, but in a similar way that, you know, you've got your Blur versus Oasis, but really the best band out of that lot was Pulp. It was always, oh, who'd you prefer, Specials or Madness? Well, actually, maybe the beat. You know, they just don't seem to get a look in those conversations, and they really should. I suppose some of it is to do with the fact that they never fully got back together. There was one gig. They played at the Royal Festival Hall, but even then, Steele and Cox were missing from that. It's such a missed opportunity. But the sound of that album, it's hard to tell whether one is just projecting this onto it because you know the fact, but it was the first album that was produced digitally. Bob Sargent, Bob Sargent was, on that album. And it's very neat and clipped and sharp. And you think, is that because it's recorded digitally or is that just completely irrelevant? I don't know. But it's an interesting fact about it anyway.
Yeah, but it is an album that does seem to be left out of conversations about what the best album of 1980 is, for instance. And it should be in every conversation that, because it's really up there.
So the following week, Mirror in the Bathroom soared 41 places to number 17. And a week later began a two-week run at number 4, and at the end of the month, I Just Can't Stop It smashed into the LP chart at number 3. The follow-up, the double A-side Best Friend / Stand Down Margaret, only got to number 22 in September, but they righted the ship when Too Nice to Talk To got to number 7 for 2 weeks in January of 1981.
What a banger that is as well. Fuck me. In the bathroom.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's a great British record now, and that's one of them. Okay, what's in a name, girls? Show them. And here's another name to conjure with. This is Kate Bush.
Outside gets inside, ooh, through her skin.
Vance, standing above three more Trisha Yates types in black Arringtons, tells us that there's some great British records about, and that was one of them. He then instructs the girls to turn around to reveal that they have Kim, Linda and Sharon printed on their backs. This is supposed to be an acceptable way to introduce Breathing by Kate Bush. We last encountered Kate Bush on Chart Music number 58, and this, her sixth single, is the follow-up to the Kate Bush on Stage EP, which got to number 10 in October of 1979. It's going to be the first single taken from her next LP, Never Forever. It came out a fortnight ago and entered the charts last week at number 44. This week it's risen 15 places to number 29, which gives Top of the Pops the opportunity to whack a video on. But let's put Kate Bush to one side for a moment, chaps. Let's talk about Arrington's, eh? Because 1980 was the year of wearing clothes with your name on. I mean, practically everyone at our school who had an Arrington would do the following. You get your Arrington, almost certainly from the market, and then you'd take it to another bloke in the market who did printing, and you'd get the name on the top rocker, get a T-shirt transfer of whatever you fancied underneath, and then you get a clanking in on the front left-hand side, and you're good to go. You're 1980 compliant.
Nobody did that in my town.
No, you're joking.
No.
Oh, man,
no.
Everyone did that in my town.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a Midlands thing, Al.
Did they do the transfer as well, Neil?
Well, yeah, these what they did was
they did.
These iron-on kind of or so-on sort of letters in the back. I've said before, you know, there was a choice. I had specials, or you could have madness.
But you didn't have your own name on it.
The own name thing, that wasn't as common. In the heat of two-tone, it was kind of between specials and madness.
Yeah.
As to what you had on the back. But, I mean, you know, I was, what, seven going on eight, and I still had that. Mm. It was something that everyone felt part of. Round here, anyway.
It would be Walt Jabsco or a specials transfer or the Madness M. That was pretty big. But you could have all sorts on it. I knew one lad who had Blonde on the back of his.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've mentioned Gormy Dorner, who had OMD on the back of his Arrington a year or so down the line.
I feel like I haven't lived, because I would totally have had the Madness M if I'd been able to, yeah, but yeah, I just don't think there was a shop in Cardiff that did that. So.
Yeah.
But what bothers me about these three girls is that their names are in different fonts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Two of them have got like this sort of Wild West handbill kind of font.
Yeah, it's very cowboy font, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And the other one's just got a sort of sans serif font. I don't know what it is, but it's like, come on, girls.
Yeah, isn't it funny how there were different fonts for different areas? Because round our way it was all Cooper Black, you know, the Dad's Army font.
It was Cooper Black round our way as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there you go, Midland style. But oh man, once again the market sorting you out. The decline of the market has resulted in the decline of pop culture, I feel, in this country.
Yeah,
now it's all fucking street food and all that shit.
Indeed. Use your markets, people.
Yeah,
or you'll lose them.
Anyway, big year for Kate Bush, 1980. She started off by regaining the best female singer title at the Daily Mirror Rock and Pop Awards in February, and 3 weeks ago Pamela Stevenson did her on Not the 9 o'clock News,
right?
You know,
yeah, yeah,
you buy my latest hits because you like my latest tits. She's just written a letter to Faith Brown thanking her for her impersonation of her and, you know, would you like to meet up for a drink? There's an unauthorised biography that's coming out very soon which claims that she's a mystical pothead dominated by her parents, and that poster of her with all the nippleage dominates every record shop in the kingdom and is gawped at by yous like me when we think no one's looking. Mm. So, yeah, she's all over the shop in 1980.
I can't believe that our generation ignored Kate Bush at the time.
Yes.
And it was only the Stranger Things generation who finally gave her any credit. Glance to camera.
No.
And here she is in a video presenting the disturbing tableau of, you know, what happens when you lose the end of the cling film.
Yes. Yes.
It's an odd video, this. But, I mean, you know, whenever
very
Kate
Bush,
as I've said before, but yeah, I've done Kate Bush before on Chart Music and mentioning the terrifying wideness of her eyes, etc. I yes. can't help but think of my missus whenever I hear Kate Bush. Not only because my missus kind of looked like her, but yeah. also because she was a huge Kate Bush fan, and these albums were a big part of our life together. And actually, my wife, she was kind of emblematic, I think, of who Kate Bush fans were in this period that we're talking about here. She was a bit too young to feel part of punk, my wife, but she'd grown up in households that were full of music, and, you know, her dad was a Cliff fan, and her stepdad was a kind of prog fan who had, like, Dark Side of the Moon and Genesis albums and all kinds of prog. Mm. So ultimately, she was someone who responded to kind of a slight bit of originality, singularity, and this fully realised musical visions. Kate Bush had that appeal to a definite set of people. I'm not saying she had no fans in London, but what I mean is she appealed to the suburban loner, I think. Kids who feel a bit solitary, kids whose folks had Floyd and Genesis albums, kids who love Bowie, kids for whom punk wasn't really going to cut it. And, you know, perhaps, I mean, notwithstanding the annoyed female heavy metal fans of the Sounds Letters page earlier, fans who weren't interested in the fantasies of metal, but did want some lushness and musicality and fantasy to their pop music. And for those kids, especially girls, to find a pop star who had this look to aim for, but also that sense of building pop from their kind of bedroom imagination outwards.
Yeah.
That a literary imagination as well. A very readily imagination.
Yes.
I think this is really important. And, you know, looking at this video, my days, what an odd, weird thing to have on the nation's top pop show.
Yes. Mm.
This song that sings about chips of plutonium twinkling in every lung.
Oof.
It's crazy. I mean, everything else on this show, you can kind of connect to something else. But this only really connects to Kate Bush. And I think that's why it connected to these kind of suburban loners out there.
Was your wife a Misty reader by any chance, Neil?
I suspect she was, yes.
Kate Bush is so Misty, it's not true. Yeah, this single, partly inspired by side three of Pink Floyd's The Wall, but mainly inspired by a documentary about nuclear war that she watched earlier this year, which I'm pretty certain is If the Bomb Drops, episode of Panorama about the government's preparations for nuclear war, i.e. the fucking isn't any. It was the first chance that British public got to see clips of the Protect and Survive public information films, but it's best known for the interview with a market trader who was asked by Jeremy Paxman what he'd do if he heard the 4-minute warning and replied, "It's a waste of time, innit, going anywhere. You've had it, ain't ya? You've had it, ain't ya? No messing about. You've had it, ain't ya?" And yeah, the song sung from the perspective of a fetus, rather in the manner of Belly Button Window by Jimi Hendrix. Yeah. In a Smash Hits interview earlier this month, she says, "It's about a baby still in the mother's womb at the time of a nuclear fallout, but it's more of a spiritual being. It has all its senses, sight, smell, touch, taste and hearing, and it knows what is going on outside the mother's womb, and yet it wants desperately to carry on living, as we all do, of course. Nuclear fallout is something we're all aware of and worried about happening in our lives, and it's something we should all take time to think about. We're all innocent. None of us deserve to be blown up."
And this baby wants a cigarette as well, because it sings about the nicotine. It's a weird little song, isn't it?
Yeah,
I didn't really pick up on the meaning of it at the time, I've got to be honest.
No, you just think, song about breathing, that's fucking boring. Look, I'm doing it now.
Yeah, I probably thought, well, it's Kate Bush doing a slow song, so it's basically another Wow or The Man With A Child In His Eyes. You know, I probably bracketed it with those and didn't really listen very closely. But when you sort of dig into it, she was kind of obsessed with obstetric matters, right down to, you know, her first album being called The Kick Inside. Mm. Yeah, but all that stuff about chips of plutonium twinkling in every lung. Fucking hell. Yeah, and she was concerned with events in the Middle East, according to an interview I found. Presumably, 1980, she's talking about the Russian invasion of Afghanistan and what might come from that. But the record company didn't get it either. They were apparently concerned that the in-out bit was pornographic.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Clockwork Orange.
Yes, exactly. They thought it was pornographic. They thought it was shagging. But the thing is, she's so confident at this point, not just as an artist, but in terms of how secure she is with the record label, that she's able to make this the lead single from the album. When, you know, the more obviously commercial Babushka was ready and waiting, and even Army Dreamers, I suppose.
Yes.
Of course, you know, later on, she'd go way out on a limb and make an album as experimental as The Dreaming, which didn't have any massive hits at all, even though Sat In Your Lap, which was a mental berserk record, got to number 11. Yeah. And then later still, she finds the kind of perfect balance of the populist and the avant-garde on The Hounds of Love. But this single at this time is a bit of a flex for Kate.
Yeah,
she's showing a muscle, saying, "Yeah, no, I can do this."
So the video, only the second one we've seen so far, isn't it? It's like Neil's mentioned, it's Kate wrapped up in cling film inside a plastic bubble. Basically, it looks like she's about to go zorbing in a nudist colony.
Yes, she's invented zorbing.
All in soft focus, so we don't see out. Mm. So sorry about that, Dad.
Yeah, she's attached to that plastic umbilical cord with the amniotic fluid represented by polythene. It's very cheap, isn't it? Like, to modernise, it looks very cheap. If someone like Billie Eilish did a song like this now, you can imagine the CGI production values of the video be mind-boggling. But yeah. I quite like the inventive sort of make do and mend, almost Blue Peter-like approach to representing what's going on.
And to be honest, a plastic bubble's got to be just as safe as a fucking door taking off its hinges and leant against your wall.
Yeah, duck and cover, fuck that, yeah.
I mean, we don't see the end of the video, which sees Kate coming out of the bubble.
Yeah, Top of the Pops cuts it off before it gets really harrowing. Mm. So we don't get the male voiceover, which I believe is Roy Harper, describing the effects of different tonnages of nuclear weapons. And then you've got Kate and her band in hazmat suits staggering about in a field after a blinding flash or wading through a lake looking traumatized with the backing vocals saying, "We're all going to die." Mm. I mean, eat your heart out, Robert Smith. Yeah. And then there's this weird happy ending where a nuclear explosion is shown in reverse.
Yes.
And then you've got Kate and all her mates all recreating Edgar Degas' Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, which was also, of course, recreated by Bow Wow Wow on their album sleeve.
Yeah.
So, yeah, an odd video and maybe a slightly cowardly decision by Top of the Pops to cut it before it gets really bleak. But then I suppose they were pressed for time.
Mm. Yeah, there is cheapness there. But even in this 2 minutes that we get, she's totally compelling and draws the eye. And I can't think of many other pop stars at that time who, thrown into a load of cling film would have made it quite so absorbing in a way. It's an amazing trick.
Yeah, she was always a little bit, "I'm a tree," and now she's, "I'm a fetus." Yeah, it's still that kind of slightly Amdram thing going on there. Yeah.
So the following week, Breathing nudged up three places to number 26, and a fortnight later got to number 16, its highest position. The follow-up, Babushka, returned her to the top five for the first time since Wuthering Heights in April of 1978, getting to number five in August of this year. And when the LP Never Forever came out a month later, it smashed into the chart at number one, making her the first woman in UK chart history to do that. Is this the first big song of the 80s about nuclear war?
Well, I mean, More Specials is about to drop, in it, and that's got Man at CNN in it. So,
yeah, that wasn't a single, though, was it?
No, it wasn't.
That's really interesting to me as well, that a lot of the other bands were much more Route 1 in their nuclear fear. Mm. Like, Man at CNA literally starts warning, nuclear attack. Mm. And you've got Kate Bush sort of doing this narrative from the point of view of a fetus. Mm. She's always got a slightly different twist on these things.
Yeah.
Which kind of is one of the reasons that it sort of passed me by at the time, because I probably needed it sort of absolutely rammed down my throat.
Yes.
In coming at nuclear war from the position of a fetus, it's oddly premonitent of the very last image in Threads, the horrifying image, which you don't see, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, haunting as fuck, man. Yeah.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, right, but I'm going to chuck it out anyway. But the last scene of Threads, right? So it's a girl who was born after nuclear war, giving birth to a baby, and she's screaming, and you can see a filling in her mouth.
Oh, right.
Right? Was that an actual fuck-up, or was it the director keeping it in to say, look, it's not real?
I don't think it was the latter. I think it must have been a fuck-up, because the rest of it is so consistent. I watched Threads again the other day, and that startling thing, the way the language simplifies towards the end, and people can only speak in real... It's just astonishing. So I reckon that was a fuck-up. I've never noticed that before. Mm.
You know, the image that everybody remembers from Threads is the woman pissing herself when she's out shopping, right? That woman, she's on IMDb as urinating woman.
Yes.
And that's her only acting job. Imagine that being your only acting job.
Where can you go from there, man?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she's etched in the memory of a generation.
What else is there to achieve?
Yeah.
I still can't believe they haven't built a fountain in Sheffield of the pissing woman. With it all trickling down her leg. And that'd be a great place to meet, wouldn't it? Oh, yeah, well, got my first date tonight with this girl. Where are you going? Well, we're going to meet at the pissing woman's leg, obviously.
Yeah, never mind the left lion.
Kate Bush at number 29 in the charts, and the song is called Breathing. Right, what's number one? I'll tell you. This is, and it deserves to be.
Bands!
crouching on a rostrum at the back of the studio, tells us that Kate Bush is one of the most original singers in the world. Then he jabs a thumb at the main stage and tells us that the band we're about to see, who are lumbering on with holdalls, towels and a steely determination, are this week's number one and deserve to be. It's Gino by Dex's Midnight Runners. We dealt with Dex's Mark II in Chart Music number 60, but this is their second single and the follow-up to Dance Dance, which got to number 40 in February of this year. It was written as a backhanded tribute to William Francis Washington, the Evansville, Indiana native, serving on a US Air Force base in East Anglia, who would slip out to front assorted R&B bands in Greater London, becoming the front person of the Ram Jam Band, who released two live LPs, which made the top 10 in 1966 and 1967, and got to number 39 in the singles charts in March of that year with Michael the Lover. Although their label, EMI, leaned on them to make it a B-side, preferring their cover of Breaking Down the Walls of Heartache, the band stuck to their guns and it came out in the middle of March, entering the charts at number 61. 2 weeks later, when it was at number 37, they were ushered onto the Top of the Pop stage, which moved it up to number 29. Then it soared to number 12, soared again to number 2, and this week it's tapped Call Me by Blondie on the shoulder and said, "Excuse me, please, but you're standing in my space." And here they are in the studio, making a very memorable entrance.
Oh, indeed.
Chaps, say what you see.
Well, I mean, first off, Tommy's spot on with his intro.
Yes.
He says this is number one because it deserves to be.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how I felt at the time, because I'd never heard a song that had so much in it, all of it good.
Mm.
And I think this appearance might have been my first encounter with this band.
Oh.
And this band, who I think me and Simon actually have discussed it previously, that the Dexys are this brilliant mix of kind of a manifesto and magic. But you can tell this appearance seems like it's another militarily planned thing by Roland.
Yes.
The way that they strut on like boxers, yes, to the ring, and they march on, they throw their coats off like it's a Soul Review, all of them deep in their sort of Johnny for Mean Streets look.
Well, they do a bit more than that, Neil. They chuck their fucking towels and a couple of holdalls into the audience.
Right.
And the audience aren't expecting it. And
no, they're not.
And they're fucking reel back in shock.
Oh, it's a hell of a way to come on when you're number one.
Mm.
I mean, I think the reason this song appealed to me and still appeals to me, and I think, you know, Dex is obviously still appeal to me, but perhaps in particular appeal to music journalists a lot, is that like so much of their work, this song is about what being into music feels like.
Yeah.
You know, you fed me, you bred me, I'll remember your name. This is a song about how music can sustain you and raise you, and how keeping the memory of that alive can become a badge of faith, a bit of a lodestone you need in an increasingly transitory world. It's number one, and it's one of the best fucking things on the show. The way they come on is amazing.
Mm.
Yeah, at this point, I do want to once again plug our back catalogue. You mentioned Chart Music 60, and if you want to know how much Dexys mean to me and to Neil, it is all there in Chart Music 60, where, you know, I talk about being a lonely teenager staring out my bedroom window, but Dexys making it feel all right to be alone, and made it feel essential to be alone, in fact. I talked about that sense of inner strength and self-reliance and self-discipline they gave me, and the conviction that even if the entire world doesn't agree with you, doesn't mean you're wrong, and how they chimed with this kind of puritanical streak I had, and all that kind of pent-up emotion and angst I had within me. So that's all there in Chart Music 60, as well as Neil's thoughts on Dexys. So if you want to hear that, go there. But to talk specifically about this era of Dexys and this song, first of all, to me, the way they storm the stage, it's like a hooligan firm taking the away end. You know,
yes.
Dexys have taken Top of the Pops here.
Yeah.
It's a great way of circumventing the awkwardness of the beginning of the single, because, you know, you've got crowd noises, chanting and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It'd be an awkward thing to start miming to. So by doing that,
it's as if it's really happening, the chanting. Nice. And of course, the chanting was something that would happen at Gino Washington gigs, the Gino thing.
Yes.
So yeah, I wonder how much negotiation it took between Kevin and the Top of the Pops producers to say, look, we're not going to just stand there. We're going to storm on the stage. But obviously they had their way. He's a very persuasive man. And yeah, the towel thing, it echoes the lyrics. You know, that man took the stage, his towel swinging high. So yeah, they actually kind of act out what the song's about.
How would it have felt to be a member of Dex's Midnight Runners and you're marching onto a stage that's got a massive number one hanging above you?
Yeah, because all the best shit from the previous performances in this episode is now suddenly on stage at the same time. So you got the round kind of things that Saxon had, you've got the kind of scaffolding that Motorhead had, and you've got this wonderful big number one logo. So it's a fucking amazing moment.
Mm. Obviously, the song owes a lot to Zoot Money's big roll band, Your One and Only Man. You've all heard that, right?
Yeah.
And the vocal ticks, obviously General Johnson from Chairman of the Boards, although apparently Kevin has denied that being the reason, but he's a bit like that, you know. whatever the obvious source of something is, he'll misdirect you. Say, "Oh no, it's not that." Mm. But I think just being what they were at this time was a stroke of genius, because subculturally, they appealed to your ska kids and your mod kids, but they're not a mod band. They're not a ska band. They're not a punk band. They're a post-punk soul band, which is an absolute stroke of genius at this time. Soul was there for the taking in terms of that big, brassy, Stax Atlantic, southern, you know, as in the southern states of America, version of soul, that kind of Otis Redding version of soul. Yeah. It was there to be grabbed and to be used and to be repurposed. And they did it fucking brilliantly. And to be a member of Dexys at that time, you must have just felt such kind of self-confidence and self-belief, particularly when this record hits number one. You think, all this shit we've been put through of rehearsing in freezing cold sheds with, a two-bar electric fire in the corner, freezing our bollocks off and earning no money and all having to wear the same donkey jackets and hats because Kevin says so. Suddenly it must all pay off. You must think, this is why we're doing it, you know?
Yeah. With absolutely no sacrifice of ambiguity, that's the whole thing. If the whole Dex's project is in a way an experiment of seeing sort of how punk's DIY idea could be applied to other music, i.e. soul, then Gino could have become just a homage, a love song to an old singer.
Yeah.
But it's not that. The ambiguity of the lyrics is really key. You know, look at me as I'm looking down at you.
Yes.
I'm not being flash. It's what I'm built to do. That suggestion that the only way of actually paying homage to these gods is to topple them in a way. And there's this weird thing. You know, they never knew like we knew. Me and you, we're the same.
Yeah.
It's almost like Chapman and Lennon. It's a real odd thing. And now you're all over. Your song is so tame. The brrr thing that Pricey mentioned, It is really important, and I do realise it probably is a homage, but it felt like when you're watching it that was a vocal tick that was his own, and it wasn't an ooh or an or some resurrection of some old soul motif. Mm. It was his. It was something new, something
it's
part Irish.
Like he was blowing a raspberry.
Yeah, but it's his. It's spontaneous, but it's, I don't know, part Irish, part Brummy, just nutty.
I agree with what you were saying about the song being backhanded and what Neil was saying about the importance of those lines. Now just look at me, I'm looking down at you. And all that stuff, you know, your song is so tame. Because if he doesn't do that, you know what this song becomes? Just a straight tribute to an old soul singer. It's When Smokey Sings by ABC.
Yeah,
that's just no good. And it's precisely because of that sort of psychological intrigue of Kevin turning the tables on his hero that the song works, I think.
It also leaves it hanging in the air that in 1992, someone's going to be singing about Kevin Rowland and saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And what really comes across on this performance, I mean, it seems like a simple and obvious thing to say, but the horns on Dex's records, they're the kind of the most strident thing in the mix, but they're also a true statement of intent. It's the horns that play the riffs that a punk band or a guitar band might have put in. And it's the horns that surge you into those moments where Dex's just lift off into this blissful groove, particularly on the Academic Inspiration bit. And the thing about horns is they do that thing of just avoiding all the pitfalls of a white rock band. There's no guitar phallocentrism. There's no soloist ego. There's this collective feel, and that is ever important. important with Dexys.
Yeah,
I think big Jimmy Patterson. Jimmy is really important on this track for exactly that reason. Because it's that hook, isn't it? It's so memorable, that the horns on that. It really, really drives the track. Because tempo-wise, it's not fast. It's without that hook, it would plod a little bit. But it does. It's more of a kind of marching thing. It propels you.
I mean, if there's one thing you can say about Robin Nash at the end of his reign, he's very up for taking a punt on a new band. I mean, Dance Dance, their first single, it was only at number 60 when he invited Dexys on, and that got it up to number 40. So, you know, who knows what would have happened to him were it not for that Top of the Pops performance.
Mm.
And this is already the fourth airing of Gino on Top of the Pops.
Right. Yeah.
Two in-studio performances and a play-out or over-the-chart rundown.
Right, yeah.
And this is a song where every time it's going to appear on Top of the Pops, it's going to draw loads more people in. Because I'd never heard a song with this many hooks in it. With this much going on, and it was just thrilling. You wanted more of it. You wanted more and more of it.
And as you said earlier, Simon, you know, what band are they? Are they Mod? Are they Scar? Again, like the Beat, there was debate over Dexys, but no, this had come on at the U Club. It got danced to. And for this, we'd do our other dance, which was called the Rude Boy Dance. You basically clenched your fists and crossed them over at the wrist, put them in front of your chest, and then bended at the knee up and down. Imagine if you'd been put in handcuffs and you were dancing for a piss. It looked just like that. And yeah, we'd dance like that to this, Message to You, Rude, and anything by UB40. So there you go.
I sort of feel like the Chart Music Video Channel needs some dance instruction videos now.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
The other thing is, I mean, you know, I didn't know the lyrics to this song for 20-odd years, really, you know, but it didn't matter.
Are you saying he doesn't sing in a clear manner?
But of course, you know, when you get to find out what Dexys' lyrics are, the songs actually get better. They get even more impossibly better when you know the words.
Yeah, I wonder how Gino Washington felt about this at the time. I mean, he's getting a massive plug, but it's by some bloke saying, yeah, you're old, I'm better.
Yeah, much like the lyrics, I'm sure he felt ambiguous.
I've been to see him live, and before he comes on, his band get a chant going of Gino, Gino, and they actually go da-da, da-da-da-da. So he's obviously decided to embrace it, you know.
Yeah.
As mentioned before, I saw him in 1986 at the Hippo Club in Nottingham, and it was the first time I'd seen anything remotely approaching a soul review, and I fucking loved it. And yes, he came up to me afterwards and said, oh, I see a lot in you, you've got a lot of potential, and all this kind of stuff. And I just walked out floating on air. Just thinking, oh my God, Gino Washington thinks I'm skilled. Not realising that he was doing the same thing all over the country, picking out lads on their own in the audience and just saying, you're fucking brilliant. I could see a lot in you. Because he did it to Ian Brown at the same time.
Yeah, but it was you. It wasn't your mate. It was you. You can have that. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Completely.
Yeah. I'm not a fucking anti-vax monkey cunt.
And this performance has elements of what would go on to be the Dexys projected passion review, where he's doing that kind of testifying thing. He falls to his knees at one point. It's kind of weird that he's got a guitar around his neck, because that just doesn't seem a very Kevin thing. But obviously at that moment it worked. But yeah, just the falling to your knees thing, that brings such a drama to that moment in the song.
Top of the Pops ought to consider the song lucky that Dexys didn't start the song the way they started at gigs, just standing there in total silence waiting for everyone to shut up and then having a go at people and telling them to fuck off to the pub if they're not prepared to listen.
Amazing.
I mean, yeah, this could have gone on for fucking ages.
This song being number one, actually, I can vividly remember, took me by surprise.
Me too. I was delighted that it was number one for my birthday. It just felt right, you know what I mean?
Well, it really knocked me sideways, because what happened with me was, I was at the School of Horror that I mentioned earlier on in the episode, and for some reason, one week, I didn't get to listen to the Top 40 rundown. I think we'd been sent on a fucking freezing cold cross-country run or something like that evening. So when it came to it this week, I remember listening to the Top 40 on Sunday evening and thinking, oh, wonder what's happened to that song that I like, that Gino song. Yeah. Just waiting for it. And you get to the top 10, you think, okay. And it's had its run. It's probably fallen out of the charts. What I didn't realise was it had soared the previous week to whatever it had, and now it had soared to number one. I had no idea. So, I it was like, what? Hang on, what? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that moment. It was so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Chaps, you know that when we research, we roll deep, and we've pulled out a quote or two from the Nolan system. sisters already, but I want to go back there because Anne Nolan's book a few years ago wrote about Dex's Midnight Runners. Quote, "For our first time on Top of the Pops with the song Spirit, Body and Soul, we could wear what we wanted. Now I cringe at the spandex trousers we picked. Surrounded by punks, we were like fish out of water. A Sex Pistol spat on our dressing room door, presumably because that's what he thought a punk ought to do. We didn't care. We had a great time." I must interject there because Sex Pistols were never on Top of the Pops person. Maybe it was one of the skids who was on, or maybe one of the Doolies. I suspect the Doolies. But she goes on. "Years later, we got a letter from Kevin Rowland of Dex's Midnight Runners. He was going through counselling and wrote to apologise for saying nasty things about us. None of us could remember him saying anything unpleasant, but part of his recovery programme, apparently, was that you said sorry to anyone you'd insulted when you were in the grip of your demons."
Yeah.
I think this is the only time Dex's Midnight Runners and the Nolans are on the same episode of Top of the Pomps, Charles.
So it must have been backstage of this episode.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe he said he didn't believe them when they said they liked Frank Sinatra. Who knows?
Well done. Well played.
So Gino would stay at number one for one more week before being stood down by the next single we're going to hear. It would become the seventh best-selling single of 1980. One below The Tide Is High by Blondair, one above Together We Are Beautiful by Fern Kinney. The follow-up, There There My Dear, got to number 7 in August, and the LP Searching for the Young Soul Rebels got to number 6 on 2 non-consecutive weeks in the same month. Great album.
Oh, amazing album.
The only thing about me and my relationship with that album is when I first got it, I was totally confused about the cover.
Did you think it was him?
Worse than that, Neil. I mean, we all know what the photo's about, don't we?
Well, it's basically the ethnic cleansing of part of Belfast, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we know that now. But at the time, I looked at that photo of that lad holding his suitcase, being rushed into a car, thinking, oh, look at that poor sod. He's got to go on holiday and he doesn't want to. He's thinking about all the telly he's going to miss.
Oh, no.
Fuck's sake. English people are such ignorant cunts about Northern Ireland. It's embarrassing, man.
Al, that is pure Partridge. That's when Alan Partridge goes about Sunday Bloody Sunday. It really does encapsulate the frustration of a Sunday.
This is Midnight Runners, and that's the number one record. It's called Oh Gino. Say goodnight, girls.
Goodnight!
Good night, everybody. See you soon again on Top of the Pops.
After a shot of a flashing red light, followed by a shot of the disco ball, we pan upward to find three more girls on Tommy Vance's gun tower, with Vance himself standing in front of the rail with his leg awkwardly crooked around the bar. Fucking hell, health and safety, everyone.
Oh, yeah, I thought he was going to go over.
Yeah, man.
I mean, you know how it is when some men, not all men, but when some get to a certain age and the daughters start bringing the mates home. And it's not like they're coming on to them or anything, but, you know, they're desperate to put over that, hey, dad's still cool.
Yeah.
There's no way that'd be allowed on BBC nowadays.
I mean, can you relate to this, Neil? Do you start sort of swinging your leg over chairs or over rails, balconies or balustrades? Yeah.
I can't say I do, and, you know, I mean, I'm constantly sitting astride chairs talking to, you know, the kids. In classroom.
Yeah.
Oh, are you that teacher? Yeah.
I call them.
Yeah, you're banging your cane on the floor.
Calling them guys, you know?
Yes. And those jeans that Vance is wearing, are they Saxons?
Mm.
They're definitely boot cut.
Yeah, they're a bit like the ones that Travolta wears in Greece, or maybe the Fonz. So they've got a bit of flair on them because that's the era.
Yeah, just a bit of a kick.
Yeah, just a little bit. Absolutely.
Yeah. By 1980, they would have been well on Saxons, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
He then gets the flower of the nation's youth to say goodnight and bids us farewell without even plugging the Friday rock show or the next track, What's Another Year by Johnny Logan. Born in Frankston near Melbourne in 1954, Sean Sherrod was the son of an Irish tenor who was relocated to the old country at the age of 3. After learning to play guitar and dabbling in songwriter as a teenager, he became an apprentice electrician while working nights as a club singer and playing the lead role in a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. In 1978, he changed his name to that of the love interest in the 1954 Joan Crawford western Johnny Guitar, signed with the French record label Vogue, and put out the single No, I Don't Want to Fall in Love, which failed to chart. After being immediately dropped by Vogue, he signed with the local label Release Records in 1979, and his next single, Ange, was his first go at the Eurovision Song Contest, coming third in that year's Irish National Final. This single, the follow-up to Angelina, which I think is the retitled version of Angie, but don't listen to me, what the fuck do I know, was written by Shay Healy, a former cameraman at RTE who became a TV presenter and spent the 70s writing parodies of ABBA songs and a musical about Elvis which came out 2 months after the King's death. It was written for the 1980 Irish Song for Europe, originally offered to the show band singer Glenn Curtin, but when he turned it down, it was put Logan's way and rearranged by Bill Whelan. After absolutely battering the competition in the national heat, it was on to The Hague, and 12 days before this episode was broadcast, it became Ireland's second Eurovision winner after Dana 10 years previously. Rushed out across Europe in the wake of his victory, it smashed into the UK chart this week at number 15, the highest new entry. And here's another chance to hear about 40 seconds of it over the usual kaleidoscopic sweep of the studio lights.
And even in the 40 seconds, I guess you can almost hear why he won. This is this insipid kind of Chris Cross style ballad.
Yes.
Christopher Cross, I should say. It's as if this year someone's decided that Eurovision has to grow up. So no more silly performances. On the actual show, he was, as I recall, sort of sat on the stage, very downbeat.
Yes.
In terms of who should have won this year, I think perhaps Telex's Eurovision, which came 17th, although they wanted to come last, I believe. Or, you know, Papa Penguin. By Sophie and Magli from Luxembourg. A sad story what happened to them. But
really?
Go on.
Oh, God, yeah. One of them committed suicide, and then the other one did not leave their house until she died, basically. Sort of about 10 years late. They were very, very tied together.
Well, penguins do mate for life, you know.
What happened to Papa Penguin, though?
I have no idea what Papa Penguin... What? He presumably swam south, you know?
Or was eaten by a polar bear.
Perhaps. Perhaps. I mean, this song, it's kind of... It's about kind of grief and lost love, but it layers it with that arrangement in so many stratums of syrup.
Yes.
It just never gets dark or anything. It just becomes this very lovelorn, you know, Ewan McLove nonsense.
Yes.
You know, although I should say, hats off to the Backroom Boys this week for lots of reasons, but I had a massive spliff on the go the other night and I watched this Asian wedding style manipulation of the lights.
Indeed.
And
got cool some, dad there.
Yes.
Got some serious 2001 Space Odyssey vibes. It's a good one. It's a good kaleidoscope this week.
Yeah, according to those who value the Eurovision Song Contest, Johnny Logan's pretty much seen as the man who saved it in its darkest hour because, you know, as we can recall, Israel had won it 2 years on the bounce and they just said, no, we're not fucking having it this year, we can't afford it. And also it was scheduled during one of their religious holidays, so not interested, mate.
Right.
Spain and the UK knocked it back because they were being minge bags, and although the Netherlands stepped in at the last minute, they did it on the absolute cheap, using the same video sequences as they did in 1976 when they last hosted it. So it was getting pretty important that the next Eurovision had to be won by some country that actually wanted it. And here comes Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
Johnny Logan saves the day with his maudlinness.
Yeah.
I was going to say it's quite rare for such a miserable song to win the Eurovision Song Contest, but then I remembered 2 years previous, as we've mentioned before on Chart Music, a Barney B's about kids getting beaten up. So
yeah. Poor old Johnny Logan sounded sad upon the radio, moved a million hearts in mono. Yeah, because we've just heard an Anglo-Irish spin on pop, Dexys.
Indeed.
But here's what actual Irish pop sounded like at the time. I think with Eurovision, it has become a gay thing because gay culture has always been finely tuned to appreciating camp in the Susan Sontag sense of failed seriousness. And it's become quite a young thing, I think, these days. Due to bands like Maneskin winning it and you know, hipster acts like Daddy Freya entering it. But it definitely wasn't young or gay in Johnny Logan's day.
No.
There's only one audience who are buying What's Another Year, and it's the mums. And it's not just mums, it's mums at their wits' end, numbed out on Valium and Gordon's gin, contemplating divorce or already divorced, I reckon. This record, it's not getting played by Radio 1, as I remember. It would be on Radio 1 precisely twice a week, Tuesday lunchtime, Sunday evening, for the duration of its chart run. That was it. The place you would hear What's Another Year is Radio 2, and specifically Wogan would have been playing it. Johnny Logan, Terry Wogan. Got to have a system, right? Yeah. So we don't see Johnny, as you say. Yeah, instead we get that fisheye kaleidoscope view of the lighting rig and credits like vocal backing, the Maggie Stredder singers, costume, and Lou Bass. Floor manager, Jeff Walmsley. Lighting, Don Babbage. But if we'd seen the Eurovision performance, we'd have seen a dreamboat. He's 25 years old. And he's a moist-lipped, blue-eyed, beautiful boy in the Donny Osmond, David Cassidy mould. And this isn't like Daniel O'Donnell, where the fans want to mother him. They definitely want to shag him.
Right, right.
So what you're saying, Simon, is he's Donny Osmond, isn't he?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
That's so shit.
Leave it in. You've got to leave it in. I've got to disagree with you both, I think, in that I think it's actually a very good song in its own ruthlessly manipulative way. It's a very appealingly romantic idea to its target audience that this beautiful but heartbroken man is so besotted that he will wait for you for a fucking year if necessary.
Oh, I think he's gone way past that. I think he's accepted that
it's not going to happen.
It's not happening. And that's it now. He's fucked.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. I just think women like that idea of power over a beautiful man. That, you know, it's quite a romantic thing. And I can imagine Karen Carpenter singing.
But he could be a widower as well, Simon.
Oh, did you interpret it that way?
I interpreted it that way. I thought it was about grief. But you know, I could be wrong. I see where you're coming from, though, Simon. He's a good-looking fella.
Yeah, I'm going to make my third attempt to say that I can imagine Karen Carpenter singing it, because I can. But the best-known cover version is by Shane McGowan from 1998. Have you heard that?
No.
Because the thing with Shane McGowan's version, he sounds pissed off and bored with the waiting, as if he's singing to the driver of a bus he's been waiting for. You know, I think Shane is playing it for comedy, which is a shame because I reckon 10 years earlier, because Shane sang it in '98, I reckon in '88 Shane would have done it straight and really done it justice.
Mm. Right.
So as you say, you know, the production's Bill Whelan, who by the way wrote River Dance. The less said about that, the better. You mentioned Shay Healy, who died only last year, the songwriter.
Really?
Best known as the host of a satirical TV show in Ireland called Nighthawks, was kind of involved in Ireland's own Watergate scandal when there was an interview with the Fianna Fáil politician Sean Doherty, which exposed a phone tapping scandal, which led directly to the resignation of the Taoiseach, Charles Hockey.
Fuck.
So, yeah. Fucking everything's connected, man. Good. But yeah, those comedy songs that Shay Healy wrote for Billy Connolly mostly.
Yes.
I listened to them. The Shit Kickers Waltz, and there's another one called The Orient Express, A Tale of Intrigue and Cross-Dressing. They're both about as funny as a drone strike on a kindergarten.
No.
But when he pulled a serious song out of the bag like this one, I've got to say, I think he's done pretty well.
So, the following week, What's Another Year soared 14 places to number 2. And the following week, it deposed Gino to assume its position at the very summit of Mount Pop, staying there for 2 weeks before giving way to Theme from MASH, Suicide is Painless. It would go on to be number 1 in Ireland, Belgium, Finland, Israel, Norway, Portugal and Sweden, but the follow-up in London failed to chart, and he entered the wilderness familiar to Eurovision winners, popping up to write Terminal 3 for Linda Martin, which came second in the 1984 contest. However, he made a reappearance in 1985 as part of The Crowd, the collective who got to number one in June of that year with a cover of You'll Never Walk Alone for the Bradford City Disaster Fund, alongside Motorhead and the Nolans.
There it is.
And 2 years later, he had another go at Eurovision with Hold Me Now, which he won, becoming the first person to win it twice. And the single got to number two in June of 1987, held off number one by I Wanna Dance With Somebody Who Loves Me by Whitney Houston. And in 1992, he wrote Why Me for Linda Martin, which won that year's contest, cementing his title of Mr. Eurovision.
You know what? I've got no memory at all of Terminal 3, the one he wrote for Linda Martin in 84. I've got no memory of Hold Me Now, which, you know, his historic second winner, number two in the UK.
I can remember
once
that.
Voted, by the way, the third best Eurovision song ever.
Really?
Probably I don't remember it because, like rock expert David Stubbs, I was too busy listening to The Young Gods in 1987. You know, I was too serious.
Oh, leave David alone!
No, seriously, man, I was. And I've got no memory of Why Me either, the Linda Martin winner from 92. I was too busy listening to Suede and the Manic Street Preachers. But I know enough about Eurovision to know that over that period, between his first win and his sort of by proxy in 92, the competition did become steadily more self-aware and more knowingly kitsch. Mm-hmm. And I found an interview with Johnny Logan from an Estonian paper, because he doesn't give many interviews, he doesn't trust the press, where he complains that Eurovision had lost its edge since his day. Lost its edge! Eurovision was losing its edge to better-looking song competitions with better ideas and more talent. And they're actually really, really nice. One for the hipsters there. He said that winning Eurovision was a double-edged sword. He says, you enjoy your success at Eurovision and the success of the winning song, sure. But then you also become the Eurovision winner, and that can be very unfashionable, certainly in England.
Ooh.
So he sounded a bit bitter there, and I thought, well, what's all that about?
Yeah.
I wondered what he meant.
Why do you think you're on Top of the Pops, mate?
Well, yeah, exactly. But it turns out he tried to be fashionable, right? In 1982, he had a new sound and on a song called Becoming Electric.
Ooh. Yes.
Which was a total flop. Now, you can imagine how I reacted to this discovery. I had to hear it. But it's not out there anywhere on YouTube or any streaming services, whether legally or illegally. I might just have to buy it. Johnny Logan, Becoming Electric. I mean, fucking up. It could be absolutely outstanding one way or another.
Didn't he change his name to just Logan?
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Maybe that's where you're going wrong, Simon.
It could be his Wired for Sound, couldn't it?
Or his Me and My Girl nightclubbing or something like that. We've got to track that down.
Because, of course, in 1982, Brotherhood of Man changed their name to BHM, didn't they?
Right,
in a doomed attempt to go a bit new romantic.
There's probably a whole playlist or a compilation album to be made of middle-of-the-road acts going a little bit new romantic.
Yeah.
Like when Manhattan Transfer did Twilight Zone and stuff like that.
Oh, yes.
I did wonder what life must be like for Johnny Logan after his 12-year Eurovision imperial phase. And I kind of imagined either a quiet retirement or, you know, maybe a modest living on the cruise ship and cabaret circuit. But he's always got something on the go. He must be minted, right?
Yeah.
For one thing, he loves an advert. He's done McDonald's and Centre Parks. So he's short of a few quid. Between 2009 and 2011, he performed in a Celtic rock opera called Excalibur.
Ooh.
Excalibur, which I've had a look at it so that you don't have to. And even as a Celtic man myself, I can report that it's fucking shocking.
No.
And this year, he was in the Belgian version of The Masked Singer as the Red Deer. And there's a film coming out about him called Mr. Eurovision. Ooh. So I guess once you've done the Freddie Mercury story and Elton John, there's only one left to do, isn't it? It's got to be Johnny Logan.
Matt, he wants to keep entering it until he wins it a third time so he can keep the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah. The Jules Rimet Eurovision Song Contest, as it's called, yeah.
And that closes the book on this episode of Top of the Pops. But 2 weeks to the day after this episode, a secret ballot held by the Musicians Union revealed that 83% of its membership were in favour of a strike against the BBC, and the writing was on the wall. A week later, before a performance of Fidelio by the English National Opera at the London Coliseum, which was to be broadcast live on Radio 3, members of the orchestra announced that if any of the BBC's microphones were set up by the time they arrived in the orchestra pit, they would down tools and walk off, forcing Radio 3 to announce the cancellation of that broadcast and put on a very big record instead. The day after that, the MU announced that it would officially go on strike on June the 1st, meaning that no BBC musicians or any other MU members would play a note for BBC TV or radio, forcing Top of the Pops off the air. As the great fizzy pop TV famine of 1980 dragged on, Robin Nash took the opportunity to step down as executive producer of Top of the Pops and pass the baton to the current producer of the two Ronnies, Michael Hurl. When the strike ended after the BBC offered to dissolve only two of the orchestras and give the 63 musos they were making redundant a fat bonus and a 5-year guarantee of freelance work, the strike was off. And when Top of the Pops returned on the 7th of August after a 9-week layoff, Hurl was in full control and change was most definitely afoot. 9 fucking episodes of Top of the Pops didn't happen, man. That's so upsetting, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder which great singles didn't get their chance to be on there.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what great singles just hovering outside the top 40 didn't get their break? Mm.
It's heartbreaking, but at the same time, I mean, perhaps as a way of getting, you know, Nash out and Hurl in, the strike was necessary as a kind of moment.
Well, it gave them a lot of time to fuck about and flesh the new Top of the Pops out.
Do you reckon, right, if they tried to carry on making Top of the Pops with sort of scab workers, you'd have had scab pop stars. Like, yeah. Oh, like, you know, some pop stars standing shoulder to shoulder with the strikers, like maybe like, you know, The Beat and UB40 and Dexys or something. But then you'd have, yeah, I don't know, maybe...
B.A. Robertson. Yeah,
oh, B.A. Robertson. Yeah. He'd be through there like a shot, definitely.
Well, B.A. Robertson did that test broadcast at Top of the Pops with Peter Powell, didn't they? You know that one where they got camera crew and floor staff to step in to pretend to be pop stars?
Yeah.
We've got to do that one
yes,
day.
Yes, please.
I wonder which presenters would be scabs as well. Most
all of
them, I suspect. Yeah.
Do you know
do you
what?
Tommy would?
Bates wouldn't, because he's, well, I mean, he's turned out to be a bit of a lefty. Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, DLT and the rest, they'd all be totally scabbing it up.
So what's on television afterwards? Well, BBC One drops in on the Sunshine Cab Company as Alex and chums try to keep Lacquer in the country by marrying him off to a prostitute in Taxi. I watched a lot of Taxi during lockdown.
Yeah.
Delighted to find out that Alex, Judd Hirsch in Taxi, proper rude boy. If he's not wearing an Arrington, he's wearing one of them MA1 green flight jackets. Fucking proper, man. Louis de Palma knows, don't argue.
Yeah.
Then it's part two of Hannah, a dramatisation of the novel about a spinster in Bristol between the war. After the 9 o'clock news, it's part one of the drama series Bull Week about a factory in the Midlands starring Mark McManus. Then Paradise in a Dream, a documentary about the Coleridge poem Kubla Khan. Then it's the news headlines, Question Time, the weather, and they close down at midnight. BBC Two is just about to finish an examination of America's inflation problems in Newsweek, then In the Making, a series of films about arts and crafts in modern Britain, follows the theatrical designer Pamela Howard about as she works on the RSC's production of Othello, starring... Who do you think's going to play Othello in 1980, chaps?
In 1980, I mean, is it a black guy?
Please, please let it be a black guy. First of all,
Donald Sinden.
What
the
Donald
fuck?
Fucking Sinden.
Oh, you know, there were black actors available by this time.
Yes. Yeah,
this is unbelievable. Donald Sinden. But I mean, Donald Sinden's a great actor in a Shakespearean sense. I mean, he enunciates well. I'm sure he did a good job, but fucking hell.
I mean, it puts David Baddiel and Jason Lee into perspective.
Well, quite.
Phil Drabble and Eric Halsall are witnesses to Istre as the first ever woman takes part in One Man and His Dog.
Wow.
Then it's part four of A Question of Guilt, the drama series about Mary Blandair, who was hung in 1752 for poisoning her dad. Man Alive nips over to America to investigate how science is helping couples choose the sex of their baby, followed by highlights of the snooker, and they round off the night with a Newsnight special on today's local elections. ITV is currently halfway through Charlie's Angels, followed by TVI, then it's the sitcom The Nesbitts are coming, followed by Shelley, the news at 10, highlights of the FA Cup semi-final third replay, which Arsenal won, regional news in your area, and they finish off with local election returns closing down at 20 past midnight. So, boys, what are we talking about in the playground tomorrow?
We're talking about Dexys, The Beat, Motorhead, Saxon. I mean, I think I'll be talking about just how cool Tommy Vance's voice is, because it just is really cool.
I mean, I doubt I actually saw this episode because we weren't allowed to watch Top of the Pops in Stalag Hollingbury. But if I had, obviously, yeah, you've got the excitement of Dexys and The Beat. But in terms of WTF, did you see that weirdness? It's Kate Bush being a cling film fetus, and maybe the bloke from Hot Chocolate who saw a UFO.
Yeah.
What are we buying on Saturday?
Dexys, Beat, Kate Bush, Motorhead, Hot Chocolate, and new music.
I have a very factual and accurate answer to this because I bought The Beat, Dexys, and Rodney Franklin. But in later years, I mean, I acquired nearly all of them. New music, Narada Michael Walden, Hot Chocolate, Nolan's, Kate Bush. In fact, honestly, it'd be easier to list the songs I didn't buy at some point from this episode.
And what does this episode tell us about May of 1980?
I think it says that contrary to sort of 1980 being seen as this in-between a year, it's got a shit ton of delight to itself. And it's actually a year where I think we can legitimately feel it's the UK charts that are pointing the way that 80s music is going to go way more than the US charts.
Oh, yes.
You know, in a way, this episode is so good. It almost makes me feel like I wish we could have had, I don't know, another 1980 before 81 and 82 came in and changed everything forever, you know? It's an amazing episode, this. And looking at this episode and also the charts, yeah, we must not undervalue 1980. It's an amazing year.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, you know, even though this isn't my favourite ever Top of the Pops, I do think it's a wonderful representation of the show at its best. If a young person asked me what Top of the Pops was all about, I could just show them this.
Yes.
It's got everything, literally, from Motorhead to the Nolans and all points in between. And it's got the multitude of genres and subcultures that were prevalent at the time, from metal to ska to disco. It's all there. I think it's a fantastic episode.
And that, Pop Craze Youngsters, concludes this episode.
Hold on a minute. There's just an important piss troll update.
This is like a Crime Watch update, mate.
It's kind of a slight update, a late-breaking plea, really. I've been talking to my dear friend, Hayley Jordan. Hello, Hayley, if you're listening.
The
person who first alerted me to the Birmingham piss troll. You know, I'm shocked to discover a couple of things about the BPT, as I'm sure all the cool kids will now be calling it. For starters, it is rumoured, and it has been rumoured, that there may be more than one of him.
No!
Yes. That perhaps even there's a whole sort of Shawnee Bean-style family of piss trolls scuttling about the canals of Birmingham. You know, in search of that sweet, salty, yellow gold. But
it's like the Loch Ness Monster. There's that theory that the Loch Ness Monster is actually several generations of the same monster.
But perhaps more poignantly, BPT, he's not been seen for nearly a decade. Last reported sighting that I can ascertain is a friend of Hayley's who swears down the Birmingham piss troll ran past his flat in 2012. He's got a flat by the canal and he swears down the Birmingham piss troll legged it past his flat window in 2012. So he seems to have disappeared off the scene a little bit. It would be wonderful if any Birmingham based pop crazed youngsters could confirm this or establish whether, you know, whether the Birmingham piss troll is gone, whether the family have moved elsewhere. The canal system in Birmingham is big. So, yeah, any kind of info from the Pop Crazed Youngsters would be much appreciated. Let's solve this mystery.
Most definitely, yes. Let's get this man. He really is a shit.
Also, Al, I'm thinking, Sharp Music, Birmingham Piss Troll merchandise by Christmas. Yes. Come on.
What the Pop Crazed Yum Yums who are listening to this need to do now is all arrange to meet up on a bridge at a certain time and have a massive whazz off it to draw him out. You know what I mean?
The only thing I can think is, you know, eventually piss might have just not hit the spot for him and he's moved on to something else. But if there's a, if there's now a Birmingham shit troll about, we need to know.
Good Lord. And on that note, this is the end of this episode of Chart Music. Promotional flange, www.chart-music.co.uk, facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast. Reach out to us on Twitter, if it's still there by the time you hear this, at Chart Music TOTP, money down the G-string, patreon.com/chartmusic. Thank you, Simon Price.
Goodbye.
God bless you, Neil Kulkarni.
Oh, thank you. No worries.
My name's Al Needham. Who's a lucky boy then?
Chart Music.
What will you remember the 80s for? The Falklands? The 87 Hurricane? A certain Prime Minister? Or will you remember the 80s for the music? The 80s was the decade that gave us the miners' strike, the property boom, and then bust. I'm living in a bus. I'm living in a cardboard bus. Do you remember all those royal weddings? Starting with me. Never thought the revolutions in home entertainment and mobile phones. And then the stock market crash on Black Wednesday. But above all, the 80s were a decade of great music. And now you can have the greatest hits of the 80s on one special collection delivered right to your door. The greatest hits of the 80s contain 64 top 10 hits and 30 big number ones. On four cassettes for just $27.99 or four CDs for $29.99 plus $2.50 postage and packing. You can't get the greatest hits of the 80s in the shops, but we'll rush it to you if you call 0800 700 600 now to place your order. Allow 21 days for delivery. The musical story of the 80s. Order the greatest hits of the 80s by calling free on 0800 700 600 now.
Rock expert David Stubbs! Rock expert David Stubbs!
Hi, my name's David Stubbs. Rock expert David Stubbs.
Rock expert David Stubbs! Rock expert David Stubbs!
Bringing you a hard-driving mix of hard rock and hard facts. As I record this, it's exactly 25 years since the death of Michael Hutchins of INXS, undoubtedly the finest rock band ever to come out of New Zealand. He rocked hard. He lived clean. Take it from the rock expert, the man who knows. He never took drugs. Just ask his wife, Paula Radcliffe, who never took them either. But I'm not here to talk about Paula Radcliffe. I'm here to talk about Whitesnake. Iconic, hard-driving. If they were a stick of rock, they'd have the word rock running through them. And let me tell you, in 1981, it took balls of thunder to rock like this, as once true rockers deserted the metal faith in droves to dance under the disco lights to David Van Day's Dollar. Thanks a bunch for turning us soft, Larry Grayson.
He's a rolling, a rocking, a rolling rock expert, David Stubbs.
Thank goodness, help arrived in the form of that 80s heavy rock movement whose acronym trips so easily off the tongue. I'm talking about New Wave of British Heavy Metal.
Whitesnake had already laid down a marker 3 years earlier with their iconic feminist anthem, Lie Down, a modern love song. A woman who truly respects herself, respects a strong man who tells her to lie down and have some sex done to her. She doesn't need me in the groin. Bogus! Anyway, let's get down to Don't Break My Heart Again. Catalogue number EC65437GS29X4. Damn. That should be EC65437G639X4. Stupid mistake, stupid. Who could forget the bass line? Doom, 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 doom. I'm standing with my back to the wall, sings Mr. Coverdale. I feel his pain. He's on his guard. If you've ever been taken from behind by a woman, you'll know what I'm talking about. Mr. Coverdale sure as hell does. Which is why I send out this message to women. To quote Mr. Coverdale right here on this song. Make no mistake, it could be your last. Because there's nothing like a maudlin, empty death threat to convince a woman who just won't lie down to lie down. And that's modern. Take it away, Al!
Rockin' and rollin', rollin' and rockin', rockin' and rollin' and rockin'!
If you want to hear more from me, rock expert David Stubbs, subscribe to me on YouTube. Address https://www.youtube.com/watch?v=QKLEH-OOFD8M%T=134S.